Lesson 1. Believe it or not.
Psst. Hey, kid. You. Yeah, you. Listen, I have a great deal for you, but don't tell anyone, okay? I'm the owner of the Brooklyn Bridge, and I'd like to sell it to you for only $20. $20 for this magnificent architectural wonder. I could easily sell it for $50, but because you look like a decent kid, you can have it for a measly $20. Do we have ourselves a deal, kid?
Believe it or not, there was a New Yorker named George C. Parker who convinced foolish people to buy the Brooklyn Bridge from him, even though he didn't own it. He also sold people other famous landmarks he didn't own: the Metropolitan Museum of Art, Grant's Tomb, and the Statue of Liberty. If he could have convinced people to buy the sun and the moon, he probably would have sold those as well. Nowadays, when people say, "If you believe that story, I have a bridge to sell you," they are referring to George C. Parker selling the Brooklyn Bridge to gullible buyers. Do you believe everything you hear? I hope you answer without hesitation, "Certainly not. Mama and Daddy didn't raise a fool." This world of ours is full of liars, boasters, and stretchers of the truth, and we might as well admit that it's no use believing everyone and everything. On the other hand, some stories are meant to be believed for the sake of enjoying a good story. Consider the well-known book Peter Pan by J.M. Barrie. In this story, we have a boy who never grows up, a shadow that gets away from its owner, children who fly, a fairy who rings like a tinkling bell, and a crocodile that ticks like a clock. The following is one of my favorite scenes, when the darling children discover they can fly. "I say, Peter, can you really fly?" asked John. Instead of troubling to answer him, Peter flew around the room, taking the mantelpiece on the way.
"How topping!" said John and Michael. "How sweet!" cried Wendy.
"Yes, I'm sweet, oh, I'm sweet," said Peter, forgetting his manners again.
It looked delightfully easy, and they tried it first from the floor and then from the beds, but they always went down instead of up.
"I say, how do you do it?" asked John, rubbing his knee.
He was quite a practical boy.
"You just think lovely, wonderful thoughts," Peter explained, "and they lift you up in the air."
He showed them again.
"You're so nippy at it," John said. "Couldn't you do it very slowly once?"
Peter did it both slowly and quickly.
"I've got it now, Wendy," cried John, but soon he found he had not. Not one of them could fly an inch. Of course, Peter had been trifling with them, for no one can fly unless the fairy dust has been blown on him.
Fortunately, as we have mentioned, one of his hands was messy with it, and he blew some on each of them with the most superb results.
"Now just wiggle your shoulders this way," he said, "and let go."
They were all on their beds, and gallant Michael let go first. He did not quite mean to let go, but he did it, and immediately he was borne across the room.
"I flewed!" he screamed while still in midair.
John let go and met Wendy near the bathroom.
"Oh, lovely! Oh, ripping! Look at me! Look at me! Look at me!"
They were not nearly so elegant as Peter. They could not help kicking a little, but their heads were bobbing against the ceiling, and there is almost nothing so delicious as that. Up and down they went, and round and round. "Heavenly!" was Wendy's word. After the story about George C. Parker and the Brooklyn Bridge, you may be thinking that all of this stuff about Peter Pan is unbelievable and nonsense. There's no way people can fly with lovely thoughts and fairy dust alone, and, after all, you don't want to be gullible. Yet here's what I have to say about that. If you think of J.M. Barrie and Peter Pan the same way you think of George C. Parker and the Brooklyn Bridge, that would be a great pity. That would take all the magic out of reading. You see, there's a big difference between the Brooklyn Bridge, that story, and Peter Pan. The first intends to harm us by stealing our money, and the second is meant to fill us with delight. The first is a real-life scam, and the second is a fictional fantasy. As a matter of fact, J.M. Barrie created such a convincing magical world that I am completely captured by it. When I read Peter Pan, I'm flying along with Peter, Wendy, John, and Michael, and I most certainly do believe in fairy dust. While I'm reading about Neverland, I believe pretty much everything that happens because J.M. Barrie is a master storyteller. While you certainly don't want to believe everything you hear, the whole point of reading a story such as Peter Pan is to get swept along to Neverland, a world of enchantment. It is possible, however, that even when you believe and enjoy a story you're reading, you still might find that some parts of it are difficult to believe. If I had to argue with anything in Peter Pan, if I had to say that something is unbelievable in that story, it would be that Peter refused to be adopted by Mrs. Darling in the end. All of Peter's companions, all of the lost boys, happily agreed to be adopted, but not Peter. Peter flew off by himself because he refused to grow up. I find it hard to believe that Peter Pan, who wanted to have a mother in Neverland, refused to join the Darling family. I'm willing to make an argument about Peter passing up the wonderful chance to have a real mother. We find many different elements in a story, don't we? Things may happen in a story that we believe, and there may be some things we find hard to believe. Things may happen that seem probable or likely, and sometimes things happen that don't seem probable at all. In nearly all narratives, we see characters who are trustworthy and good examples of virtue, as well as other characters who are pretty repulsive. We see characters' actions that are proper and improper, and everything in between. Sometimes part of a narrative itself can be very clear and understandable, and other times it can be unclear and hard to understand. So what do we do when we see parts of a narrative that are unbelievable, improbable, unclear, or improper to us? We refute them. That means we criticize those parts and explain why we are doing so. We will explain these four terms thoroughly in Lesson 6. When we see parts of a narrative that are believable, probable, clear, or proper, we confirm them. That means we explain why we think those parts are praiseworthy. In some ways, you could see refutation as an attack and confirmation as a defense. Refutation, a short essay that attacks certain parts of a narrative. Confirmation, a short essay that defends certain parts of a narrative. Refutation and confirmation, these are the two main types of written exercises you will practice in this book. Your job in this type of writing is to persuade your readers that your opinion is right. Now, you may be tempted to ask, why on earth would I want to spend my time picking apart narratives? Doesn't that take some of the magic out of them? Let me assure you that this exercise is not about taking the magic out of stories. On the contrary, this exercise is designed to make you love truly good stories even more because you think about them more deeply. When you slow down and think carefully about what you read, you discover so much more to the story and are able to savor it, just as you would enjoy a meal better by slowing down to taste its different flavors and spices. Refutation and confirmation are also wonderful ways for you to become a discerning, clear-thinking reader. You have all sorts of messages coming to you through the magical narratives of movies, televisions, plays, video games, and books, and it is wise for you to grow in your understanding of what your mind and heart are absorbing. Recently, I came across this popular joke. A lady gets on a bus with her baby in her arms. The bus driver says, "Yowza, that is the ugliest baby I've ever seen." The lady goes to the rear of the bus with an angry look on her face. She sits down and says to another passenger, "The bus driver just insulted me." The passenger says, "How rude. You go up there and give the driver a piece of your mind, and I'll hold your monkey for you." After I got over my chuckles, I thought more deeply about this joke. I wonder if it might cause some new parents to feel badly about their babies. One way to refute this joke would be to argue, there's no such thing as an ugly baby. All babies are beautiful. Or even better, I might argue that it's improper to insult someone's baby, a child who is dear to its parents and loved by them. On the other hand, there's something very trustworthy about this joke, something worth confirming. The joke demonstrates that there are plenty of rude people in this world, and that's worth knowing. As you can see, looking at the joke from different angles helped me to think more deeply about the joke itself. Remember to keep the big picture in mind. You are marching down the road toward rhetoric. Rhetoric is the art of writing and speaking persuasively, and the more fully you understand stories, the better your own stories will be when you are called on to tell them. Stories are very persuasive, as much now as at any time in history, and that is why we dwell on them. You must also learn how to argue for what you agree with and against what you don't agree with. What better way to learn to do this than with stories? Now that you understand the ideas of refutation and confirmation, take a look at one story in particular and start considering how you might refute or confirm parts of it. It is the story of John Henry, the amazing steel driver of the C&O Railway. A steel driver hammers holes in rock for the placement of explosives. Henry may have been a real person who was an ex-slave from Mississippi and worked on the expansion of railroads after the Civil War. The legendary contest in John Henry's story takes place during the construction of the Big Bend Tunnel in West Virginia during the 1870s. As you read it through, think about how parts of the story can be either refuted or confirmed. In other words, think about what parts of this narrative are worthy of praise or criticism. The Legend of John Henry, adapted from John Henry, A Folklore Study by Lewis W. Chappell. John Henry was the best steel driver on the Chesapeake and Ohio Railway. He was the only man who could drive steel with two hammers, one in each hand. People came from miles around to watch him drive steel with his two 20-pound hammers. Two different railroad companies were working towards each other from opposite directions and planned to meet in a place called Big Bend Tunnel. One company had a steam drill, while the other used manpower to drill. When the two companies met, everyone asserted that the steam drill was the greatest invention ever. But John Henry claimed, "I can sink more steel than any steam drill ever could." A contest was arranged along with a monetary prize. John Henry could win $100 for beating the steam drill. John Henry had his foreman buy him two 20-pound hammers for the race. They were to drill for 35 minutes. When the contest was over, John Henry had drilled two holes 7 feet deep, which was a total of 14 feet. The steam drill had only drilled one hole 9 feet deep, so the prize was given to John Henry. When the race was over, John Henry went home and told his wife that he had a queer feeling in his head. She prepared his supper, and immediately after eating, he went to bed. The next morning, when his wife awoke and told him it was time to get up, she received no answer, and she immediately realized that he had died sometime during the night. His body was examined by two doctors from Baltimore, who discovered that his death was caused by a burst blood vessel in his head. Speak it. The Ballad of John Henry. Captain says to John Henry, "Gonna bring me a steam drill round. Gonna take that seam drill out on the job. Gonna wop that steel on down. Lord, Lord, gonna wop that steel on down." John Henry told his captain. Lightning was in his eye. "Captain, bet your last red cent on me, for I'll beat it to the bottom or I'll die. Lord, Lord, I'll beat it to the bottom or I'll die." Sun shined hot and burning. Weren't no breeze at all. Sweat ran down like water down a hill. That day John Henry let his hammer fall. Lord, Lord, that day John Henry let his hammer fall. John Henry started on the right hand. The steam drill started on the left. "Before I let this steam drill beat me down, I'd hammer myself to death. Lord, Lord, I'd hammer myself to death." Oh, the captain said to John Henry, "I believe this mountain's sinking in." John Henry said to the captain, "Oh my, ain't nothing but my hammer sucking wind, ain't nothing but my hammer sucking wind." Captain asked John Henry, "What is that storm I hear?" He says, "Captain, that ain't no storm. 'Tain't nothing but my hammer in the air, nothing but my hammer in the air." John Henry was hammering on the mountain, and his hammer was striking fire. He drove so hard till he broke his poor heart. And he lied down his hammer and he died. And he lied down his hammer and he died.